The Five Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, good morning, Portland, Oregon. What a wonderful day. It's a little overcast, but it's supposed to be about 70, 75 today. So a great day to get out there and do some fun things. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We try to answer your questions, whether it relates to investing or taxes or legal. And in the studio this morning with my co-host, Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Carl. And Kevin Steggy with the Baker Coastal CPA Firm.
Good morning, Chuck and Carl. Good to be here.
And Kevin, have you been out doing some more? You called me the other day from the Banfield to give me a heads up on the traffic today.
Yeah, that's a good one to avoid if you're in the Portland area, that's for sure. But it should be good when they're all done.
Well, you know, coming in from Vancouver today, I took I-5, and I normally take the 205. And I noticed a little more traffic than normal, but it really wasn't bad at all. I don't know about you guys when you drove in, but it really wasn't bad.
I just picked my way over the Powell and the Ross Island Bridge, so not too bad.
Well, I tried Powell at first, and I became frustrated because I seemed to be hitting lights and things, and so I shifted on over to Stark and then came down and went over the Morrison Street Bridge. So worked out well.
Well, that's great. Well, listen, we're going to talk about some investing today and talk about the stock market because there's been a lot of things going on, and I like to run my current little update on the market. But before I do that, I am going to mention an article that I read this morning in the Columbian, and I know many of our listeners do take the Columbian. Most probably take the Oregonian, however. But there is a guy that I've mentioned numerous times by the name of Malcolm Burko, and he can be reached at mjburko, B-E-R-K-O, at yahoo.com. You can go on the line and check him out. He writes articles all over the country. He's a very wealthy multimillionaire who is a self-made man, and he's very opinionated. And I have to say I agree with his opinion about 99% of the time. And he's got a real interesting article here. A young man from college writes into him and asks him about, says that, you know, he's taken a college course, and they're trying to figure out, how do you really figure out the unemployment rate? And he basically tells him that, good luck on that one, but tells him that he goes through how they're actually calculating unemployment, which really doesn't calculate unemployment. So it's an interesting thing to read. If you're wondering about unemployment numbers when you hear them, you know, I think the ones that most people are thinking about is the one that they generally say is about 7.8 or 7.6. The amazing thing is, it's amazing when there's more people unemployed, the number doesn't move. That's kind of amazing. The other thing that I've noticed that is really a shock, I got it on my, and I hope our listeners out there have went online and checked out my website at www.pfgwm.com and signed up for Harry Dent's daily newsletter, Survive and Prosper, and you need to go on my website and do it, or you can go to www.harrydent.com. But I was reading an interesting part of that, and Kevin, I know you signed up for it, and I don't know if you saw that, but they were showing a little thing that for the last 60 days, the national debt clock has not moved. Hmm. Now, that's not, and sequestration is what's done it, because nobody's talking about that. And I would have thought some of the conservatives who cut budgets would have came out and said, hey, it's working because we're not increasing the deficit. At least we're not increasing it. They're not decreasing it, but it's staying pretty flat, which is kind of interesting because I don't ever remember that happening in all the years I've ever looked at it. I've never seen it for that long a time be at a flat line, which I think is good news. You know, if you want to look at that aspect of it, I think that's very good news. Well, the Dow Jones closed at 15,543.74. It was negative this week. It was down 4.80 on Friday, and that's 0.03%. However, where do we stand versus when before the crash, when we hit the all-time high on 10,907? And we're up a whopping 9.74% in 5 years and 9 months. And that works out to a 1.69% year return. So recovery, I would like to see a much stronger recovery, in my opinion.
Is 10,907 the all-time high, or did we actually crest that here within
No. We've done it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying most people, and what gets me about the guys on TV, they always think everybody had the wisdom to get out of the market and jump into the market at the bottom. The reality is most people rode it out. They didn't get out, and they didn't get back in. Most people just rode that up to that high in 07, and then when it tanked in 07 and 08, then they rode it back up.
And they're back and just about back to where they were.
Well, they're actually up about 1.7% per year. I mean, that's, you know, better than a CD. Not better than inflation supposedly, but the S&P closed at 1692. It was up 2.72. Now the S&P is actually not quite done as well as the Dow Jones. The S&P is up 8.11% in 5 years and 9 months, so it's up 1.41%. And you would think historically growth should outgrow growth in income, but it's not. And that's another thing that people need to be looking at is, are the growth stocks really growing in this country? Are we growing companies? And I was looking at some numbers of Bank America, and they were talking about the great report that Bank America had. I don't know if you saw it or not, but they've laid off so many people and turned so many people into part-time employees that they better show some better numbers. If you're letting people go and you're cutting down your employment costs, you better show a little better numbers. So I
don't
think
know. I'm with Harry Dent. Do we really care about Bank America? Do we, you know, well, should they be here at all? Should they?
a good friend of mine calls them Tank America because they're too big to fail.
Yeah.
But anyway, oil closed at 108. Oil's been going up, and we all notice it at the gas tank. It was 106 last week, went up 108 this week. And gold is still trudging to try to come back. Gold closed at 1295 and was the week before at 1283. Here's the interesting thing, and this is something that Bernanke came out and came back in, and when he talked, the rates jumped up about 35%. A 10-year bond rate this week, though, went down. Actually started coming back down, and if you know, listening about the loan rates and stuff, the rates actually came back down. And last week they were at 2.6, and this week they closed at 2.49. So I think it's kind of interesting to see what the Feds. It seems like every time the Feds talk or Bernanke talks, the market reacts, and maybe more so than it needs to. But the reality is, they're still pumping $85 billion a month into the economy.
Yeah, you know, you talked earlier about the unemployment rate, and, you know, I think they changed the calculation for that. Was that back in the Clinton administration or somewhere back then? And at least they're using the same calculation year after year and fulfilling the good old accounting principle of consistency, which gives us some comparability. But I think if you really took the amount of people that want to be employed or want more employment and get off the part-time roles, that's quite a bit higher rate. And I believe Bernanke alluded to some of that a little bit in his last report here.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you say that about accounting methods and accounting methods. And one of the things we're going to be talking about here in the next couple of months is you and I are going to have some discussions on accounting methods, because I had a discussion with a firm here in town that is a very large money manager. They manage money all over the country. And their president is a very, what do you want to say, analytical type person. And him and I was discussing some numbers on average annual returns and going through those numbers. And it is an acceptable accounting method, even though, and as I'll point out clearly in my book, it's an acceptable method, but it really doesn't work. The numbers aren't right. And we'll go through that, and I'll be talking about it. I have talked about it on the show before, but average annual return means nothing. The only thing that really matters to you or me or anybody else, if we have money, what did that money do this year, and what did it make us? And from the time we put the money in, what has it grown to? Has it grown, and how much has it grown? That's what I care about.
What's that old adage, liars never figure and figures never lie? I'm not sure about that either.
Well, I think you said that almost the opposite, but it's figures don't lie, but liars figure is the way I heard it. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments. This is a great morning for you to get up, have that cup of coffee or a cup of tea or whatever else you might drink. I don't know. I got a mineral water. But whatever else you might be drinking, and pick up that phone and give us a call at 503-417-7626, 503-417-7626. Got a line open, so give us a call, and if you got a question, we'll give you an answer. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be right back.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl's comments, and this is when I talk about something that's come up in my practice in the last little while. And one of the things I call this comment, retirement, the golden goose, and the lottery. And the reason I do that is, and it comes about in the thought that I was speaking with a client who was fortunate enough to be a fairly successful business person, and we were talking about doing his estate plan. And of course, we try to figure out, what do they want to do? What are your goals? What are your aspirations? And he had some children, and one of the things he said really struck me with a certain kind of wisdom. He wanted to provide for his children, but he wanted to make sure that the way that we provided for the children was not going to give them an incentive, or rather a disincentive, to finish their education and to make a life for themselves. He did not want them to become, you know, just dependent on whatever they were going to get from him. And in fact, he wanted to make sure that they couldn't do that, but that they would always have, you know, support, but that if they wanted to live a life of luxury, they were going to have to do it on their own. And, you know, there's a certain degree of wisdom in all of that. And I got to thinking about it, and some of the happiest people I've met are people who do some good with their money. So the retirement and the golden goose and the lottery goes something like this. If you're fortunate enough to have just enough to support your children, admonish your children that your death will not be a golden goose for them. If you are fortunate enough to expect a significant surplus in your retirement, admonish your children that your death does not mean they win the lottery. Use your money for good during life and use your money for good after you die. That's where we get into charitable giving. If the main thing your child remembers you from is what you left them, what does that say about you? You gave them life. You clothed them. You fed them. You taught them wisdom, hopefully. You provided them with education. You gave them the tools to become a productive, good citizen and adult. So charitable giving can do a lot of real good things. You can save lives. You can cure diseases. You can educate needy children. You can help the disabled. Maybe you can even save a soul or two. And there are some tax advantages to that as well. So what you want to do is go forward and look at what is your tombstone going to say. Do you want it to say he had a lot of stuff? Or do you want it to say he made a real difference in the lives of those who needed help? And the thought here is, you know, one of the things we do sometimes is we forget about what we want to do with our money and what brings us satisfaction, and we kind of focus on one thing. I mean, most everybody comes in and say, well, I want to take care of my wife and my kids. Well, of course we do. But how do you do that? And what else can you do? I mean, if that's all that you do, you know, maybe you could do a lot more. If everybody had somewhat of a charitable spirit, imagine how much a nicer place we might have. Anyway, those are my kind of philosophical thoughts on Carl's comments this morning.
You know, Carl, makes me think about a client that I have that a couple of guys that have built a business for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, and they actually took over a business from their dad, and they built the business up very, very successfully. But they're kind of married to their business. I mean, it's not, you know, most businesses you have to stay hands-on. And theirs is that way too. But the amazing thing is they've got none of their kids want to take over their business. And so that's a big problem for a lot of successful people who start a business and all of a sudden they've built this wonderful business and now they've got nobody that really wants to pass it on.
You know, this is quite a common thing. Actually, what I've seen many times, and this is not mean to be discouraging, but many times I've had clients who come in a similar situation, and they have a flourishing business that they've, you know, put their sweat and tears into over many years, and they have maybe several children, and none of them want anything to do with the business. And you know, a lot of times, you know why that is? Because they've grown up with their dad or their mom, and they saw how hard they worked, and they don't want to work that hard. They don't want to be spending weekends and nights. They don't want to be, you know, worrying about it all the time. Yeah. And, you know, they just don't want to do that.
And thanks to mom and dad's money, they don't have to work that hard.
Well, that depends. If you follow the philosophy that I just talked about, then maybe they do. But
that's exactly right. You know,
yeah, it's a hard thing.
I was associated with a particular situation where the husband and wife were probably the top 10 or so, position-wise, of a very successful tech company, which everyone would know the name of, and they retired many years ago. So you know they were very well off. That was back when there were actually true pensions through some of these companies and stuff. And the husband passed away. The wife had it doing tax planning for all of these multi-millions. And she had one son who she called a ne'er-do-well and was not interested in leaving him much money. She was not charitably inclined. So the culmination of all of this life's work and the savings, and she did not want to spend her money, was basically give it to the government when she passed away. And that's kind of it seemed like there were some better uses that she could have done with some of that. But, you know, sometimes you know, I guess that's where some of the philosophical comes in, and I think is a very important. A lot of what we do is a little bit of creative art mixed in with a lot of cold hard tax planning science. But I think your personal philosophies, I think, affect a lot of what the tax plan's or the estate plan is going to be.
Well, one of the interesting things is that, in fact, I just recently had this come up in a case, and that was where the parents were charitably minded, and their children were good children, worthy of being bestowed with additional wealth, I guess. But they also, you know, so they tried to balance those two things. And what it ended up being really was that in the long run, by balancing those things by some charitable giving and providing for the children and providing for the surviving spouse, they were basically able to accomplish all the goals. And so kind of everybody came out a winner in that deal. That's not always the case, but they did a really thoughtful, careful kind of thing. And so it was very interesting, I thought, and you know, it was really fun to do that. Indeed, this fellow that mentioned about his children, he wants to make sure that they have whatever inheritance they get in such a fashion that it doesn't give them disincentives to be productive citizens. I'm working on that now, and it's a bit of a challenge. We're trying to figure out how to do that, be fair, and be tax aware, and all of those kinds of things. So that's going to be an interesting project for me.
Yeah, it's a real balance of trying to do the right thing and not to do the wrong thing in that case and to spoil them, but to keep them encouraged to success for themselves. And I think that's a hard thing. I know I've had clients that when we got together with them on the planning, they didn't have any relatives. And a lot of times they'll end up, one particular client I can think of, she left a large of her money to the Humane Society because her pets were her life. And that's true with a lot of people out there. They don't have family, and maybe their little dog or their cat or whatever is their part of their family. And they'll leave that to the Humane Society, and that's a great thing too. I mean, I think anytime you leave it to an organization that can do something good in an area that you cherish yourself in life, I think is a great way to do it. It gives you a little bit of a legacy that maybe you wouldn't have had.
You know, there's another kind of flip side to things, which is when a person, you know, ends up with a modest estate. You know, they worked hard all their life, but maybe they had some real medical issues, or who knows? You know, they had some setbacks, and as a result, through their retirement, they had to spend a lot more money than they really expected. Maybe they made bad investments and they didn't have what they wanted in the end, but they lived a reasonably good life during their life, and they you know had a fairly high standard of living, and their kids are sitting out there and they're saying, "Man, I'm going to have the lottery," you know, and the problem with that is because if they really believe that, a lot of times it's not true. And I can't tell you how many times we've had lawsuits and stuff like that. And the real reason for it is that the kids take a look at it and they say, "There's got to be more than that. You know, there's got to be more than that. You must have stole it, Mr. Personal Representative or Mr. Trustee. You must have taken it from the estate because we knew that we were going to get a lot more money than that." And in fact, one of my colleagues at work here just tried a case, a 3-day case on that very issue. And he was representing the personal representative. He won it hands down, but it cost a lot of money. And, you know, the family still hates each other. And the whole thing was we should have got more. And that was the basic theme of the whole thing. So for those, one way to, I think, quell some of those kinds of storms is to, as you grow older, to be honest with the kids. Let them know really what your resources are. I know that's kind of a hard thing for people to do. But if your resources are in fact meager and you think your kids are going to expect a whole lot more than there really is, then before they get into the big fight, you might want to let them know what their real story is.
Yeah, I think that's great advice.
Yeah. You know, I think there's another planning method that I think just really works well. You know, sometimes kids and children just need some time to grow up. Sometimes your child is going to just give you grief throughout your whole lifetime and such. But, you know, having a trust provision or something that gives incentive to become productive in society and to accomplish things in life. And then, you know, have a payout later in life, 30, 35, even 40 or something, is not a bad idea. And I've seen that work fairly well. And I've never really seen that be a problem. Like somebody just, they died because they didn't get their money paid out. You know, I've never seen it work poorly. But, if you wait till later in life, it seems to help a bit.
Well, there's no question that those kind of provisions are fairly common, although a lot of times, well, maybe they're not that common. A lot of times they just say give it to the kids. But those work really well if you have responsible kids. If you have the irresponsible kid, then they get mad. They want, you know, it's like that advertisement on TV, you know, it's my money, I want it now. And that's what they do. And then they fight with the trustee and stuff like that. But you can fix that too. You can put essentially what amounts to a no contest clause that says the trustee can cut you off if you become a pain in the neck. So,
well, you know, sometimes you, in this day and age, sometimes you have a kid that has a drug problem.
Exactly.
And you and I know of a case where a parent had a house and provided for this person and made sure that they at least they had a house. But even sometimes if you're doing that and you have an incentive for this guy to have an incentive, his drug problem was so bad, it overtook all that other incentive to do good, and it didn't work out very well.
Well, ironically, the way that I got involved with that case was through litigation, because the trustee, who was this fellow's sister, I remember it so well, because she came into me, and what she wanted from me was not some interpretation of the trust, but she wanted me to file an action in court for a restraining order, a stalking order, against her brother. And it turned out that the brother had threatened to blow her up. And I said, "You really think that's serious?" And she said, "Well, he was a munitions expert in the military." and I said, "I guess that's serious."
It could happen.
So I can remember very vividly going down on this stalking order before then Judge Redding and saying, we want this stalking order. He says, "So what is the story?" And I said, "Well, actually, you see, the defendant here, threatened to blow my client up." And he says, "Okay." And so anyway, we ultimately got the stalking order. But over a period of years, while that was a difficult thing, the trust did serve a real purpose, because this fellow was able to live in his house and have his bills paid and have medical care and have some kind of a life for quite some time. But it ultimately didn't work out, because ultimately he ended up basically dying from drug-related issues. But he lived for a lot longer than he would have had they given him a whole bunch of money. So
yeah, it's really funny. You know, you meet these people in your life, and his mother, when I met her years before that, and she was a longtime client of mine. She didn't even have a high school education. She worked hard. She drove truck. And she actually started buying real estate. And then she got successful in real estate, and she sold it, and then she started investing in investments. But I was totally amazed when I met her, because for somebody with no educational background at all, she was very self-learned. I mean, she read a lot, she studied a lot. And if you met her, you'd probably think not, because she had a cigarette and a cup of coffee. But the reality was, she was a very, very shrewd lady. And very smart and very self-made, which I thought was really neat. And she was concerned for her kids. And as it turned out, she did the right thing. It worked out very well. Well, listen, if you got a question about estate planning, taxes, or planning your estate, planning your will, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. 417-7626. I can't believe everybody could be watching the British Open today, but maybe they are. If you got a question, give us a call. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified with Kevin's the tax investigator.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified here on a Saturday morning, Portland, Oregon. And I think we have a caller, Rob, on the line with a question about Social Security. Rob, are you there?
Yes. Hello?
Hello. What is your question?
Yeah, I have actually four questions on that. First question is that I heard that a person could take their Social Security and then repay the Social Security back to Social Security and then be able to bump up to the higher level of monthly payments?
Yes, that is true, I believe. If you start taking it, say, at age 62 and 6 months in you decide that you want to hold off on Social Security, you can repay that, I believe, within certain time frames. I don't know the exact rules on that, but then...
Generally speaking, it's up to 1 year.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And then you're back into the holding period, and you can wait till you're 65 or 70. That's correct.
Okay. So second question is on spousal benefit from Social Security. Once a person reaches either age 62 or 65 or 66, whatever they're going to go for, is the spouse eligible at that point, even though they're not that same age?
Okay, and you're talking, no, they have to reach 62. However, there is a widow's benefit if they're 60 and you pass away, they can start getting it at 60. But they cannot get it before that. Of course, they only get it at 60 if you pass away. And then they can't get the other benefit till they're 62. They either have to take off of yours or off of theirs.
Okay, so you're saying they could take off their own at 60, or they could take off...
No, at 60 is a widow's benefit. You'd have to pass away, and that's not the way to get the claim.
Yeah.
You don't want that to happen. The only way they can take it at 60 is if somebody passes away. They can draw it as a widow's benefit. But at 62, if you're, let's say you're 4 years older than your wife, you start taking your Social Security at 62, well, she can't take hers or she can't take off of yours until she's 62.
Okay.
Well, that's the law right now. I don't know how, it depends on your age. And have you looked at Social Security as far as to find out your maximum age that you can take it out at?
Well, the maximum starting age is 70, isn't it?
Okay, well, it depends on your age now. I mean, for younger people, it does go to max 70. But, like, for example, some people right now, if they retire, the maximum benefit they get at 66 where they can take the money and work too, that is moving out as we go.
Full retirement age is moving
full
up
retirement
from
age.
65 to 66 to 67, I believe. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, that kind of answered my questions, I think.
Okay, well, hey, thanks, Rob. Thanks for calling.
One more that I have, if you still have a minute.
Sure.
Okay, the other one was that I'd heard some kind of an advertisement that a person can get like a 60% increase in benefit if they do a something called apply and suspend.
Well, it's file and suspend. Yes, that is correct.
And how does that work?
Well, it's going to depend on your age and your situation. We'd have to take a look at it. And if you want to call my office, I will be glad to run a report for you to show you how you could take advantage of it. And there's no obligation to you. There's no charge. There's no fee. There's no, you know, you won't be pressured or anything. We'll just run the evaluation for you, and then you can take a look at it and see how it works for you.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, so that's available to anybody?
Pardon?
That benefit is available to anybody?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, if they're eligible for Social Security, you bet.
Okay.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Rob.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, we've got another caller on the line who's got a question about trusts. It looks like it's David. David, are you there?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, good morning. I got a Carl question. My mother has dementia. She has a living trust, and my brother's a trustee. And for some reason, he decided not to wait until she passes and get an inheritance. He dips into the trust. I'm going through a process of removing him as trustee. During the proceedings, part of his defense is some of her accounts, which she has multiple accounts, was not in the trust, therefore he wasn't stealing from the trust. So
you've got the difference between a breach of a the difference is I guess if that were really true, which I don't know, but you've got either a breach of his fiduciary duty as trustee, or you've got elder abuse, financial elder abuse. Either way, it's wrong.
Isn't it the responsibility of the trustee if he discovers that some accounts have not been placed in the trust that he needs to do that as trustee as part of his duties?
Well, generally, it depends on the timing of all of that. Generally what happens is, in my case, what we typically do, that we rely certainly on the information that we get from the client, and I don't know how other people do it, but we always at least start out with writing a letter to the various institutions. And say, okay, and the letter is signed by the client that goes to, say, the bank or, you know, the brokerage, and it says, we just set up a living trust. Please transfer these accounts into the trust. I know you're going to make me file some other, you know, sign some other papers, but this is my instruction to you to put it in the trust anyway. And the idea behind that is that if something really bad happens and they never get around to go filling out the forms at the bank, is that ultimately you can, and it's a bit of a process, but ultimately you could end up having those assets transferred, because there's some case law in Oregon which says that once you've done all that you can and manifested a direct intent to transfer assets to a trust, the law presumes that it's already done. And now, getting that actually done from the standpoint of getting the bank or whatever to acknowledge that may be a bit of a process, might even involve a lawsuit, but at least that's the safety valve that we try to install on those kinds of things.
You know, the other question I would have is the accounts that he accessed, Carl, and you'd have to answer this, what if the mother had joint accounts set up with this other brother? And they were joint bank accounts, which allows either person to cash out the money.
Well, unfortunately, that's a little bit of a gray area, because a joint bank account is presumed to be owned by both parties, so either one of them can take it out at any time. However, you can certainly show that, because this is a very common practice amongst families to add somebody onto the account as a joint owner. I don't recommend it, but that's what people do. And the purpose is so that the child usually is managing mom or dad's bills, and they write checks and things like that. But it's really not their money. And so either way, if they abscond with the money and it's a joint account, I suppose you could argue that it's their money. But as a practical matter, it probably constitutes financial elder abuse by, you know, really taking mom's money and using it for personal purposes.
Yeah, particularly once they have the fiduciary responsibility as the trustee to handle her money while she's alive.
Right, right.
Right. Yeah, I just got that yesterday as an argument that, yeah, well, I am the trustee, and the money that I've been taking isn't necessarily in the trust.
Well, the point being there, I think, is that it's really the responsibility of the trustor to get the money into the trust as a practical matter, because we as the lawyer can't. What we tend to do is we try to follow up as much as we can, and we try to get everybody to cooperate, and we give instructions to do that. But a lot of times those instructions don't get followed, and you know, we can't always know. We ask our clients to get back with us and let us know that they've accomplished everything, but we can't, you know, possibly know, and sometimes they just don't, you know. So,
yeah.
So once it kind of goes out, that's a challenge. But I think the point being, though, that either way, it's certainly not, you know, just because it's not in the trust doesn't mean that it's the trustee's money.
Well, the other way for
reasonable, honest people kind of believe that, but obviously that's not the case going on here. So
I don't think most judges would buy off on that argument much.
Okay, yeah, I whether it was planned or just by incompetence on my brother's part of not going to the banks, you know, it's just it is what it is. But thanks for the advice, you guys. You got a good show and a lot of good information. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, David.
Well, real good. Those were two great calls, covered a wide range of topics there. So continuing on here with the tax investigator, we're just going to touch on a couple small things here, and then I think we'll have an interesting discussion about a famous person's estate that recently passed away and maybe some plans or ideas they could have done differently, or maybe not, depending on, you know, what they did. But one thing to note, new for this year, for 2013, the IRS has enacted a safe harbor method for calculating the home office deduction. One of the drawbacks to the home office deduction was the Form 8829 is a pretty involved form, and you got to put a lot of stuff down on there. You've got to depreciate your home. It takes time to gather all that information, you know, either for our clients or just as a taxpayer yourself, accumulating all that information. But the new safe harbor method is $5 per square foot up to 300 square feet of qualified home office use. So a maximum deduction of $1,500. For the smaller home offices, this is probably a good way to go. Should be more simple. If you have a larger home office, you may be losing some deduction by going this route. It may be better to go the actual route. Kind of similar to the mileage deduction. Simplifies things at 55.5 cents a mile. Don't have to keep all your actual receipts. But and in the case of the mileage, that's just a wonderful allowance, frankly. That's a pretty good. This one isn't quite such a great allowance, but it could help some taxpayers. So just to note, new for 2013, home office safe harbor deduction, $1,500. Another item that I think taxpayers and our listeners need to be having in the back of their minds for future planning for this coming year, in the coming years, related to Obamacare, is the potential use of an HSA in conjunction with the health insurance. With probably deductibles going up with the new Obamacare rules and stuff, that seems like it's going to be a reasonable thing that people are going to be paying more out of pocket. If you have a plan that fits the high deductible, the health savings account rules, you may want to just have in the back of your mind that this may be a good route to go, and we'll see how it plays out. We really don't know if those are going to be allowed in this situation. I read one article where someone technically said it may not work, but from what I'm hearing, a lot of people are looking at those as options for their employees, or if you're an employee, for yourself outside of your employer's provided health insurance, it may be a good way to go. What I like about HSAs is the money that you contribute each year. You get, I believe it's about $3,250 for a single person and $6,450 for a married couple. That's how much you can contribute to your HSA in the year. Say you don't pull money out of your HSA. and you keep putting this amount in each year. Well, that amount continues to grow. You're not required to pull it out. And once you reach age 59 and a half, it becomes a retirement. It's like an IRA. And so it's really...
So it's tax sheltered, it stays deferred, and then do you ever pay tax on it, or is it tax-free if you take it for medical expense?
Well, once you reach 59 and a half, you can start pulling it out, even for non-medical expenses.
And tax-free.
And the earnings, no, at that point, I think you would pay tax if you don't pull it out for medical purposes. But that's the same as any other IRA.
Oh, yeah.
So that's it's not a bad way to go for a quasi-retirement / medical plan.
Well, it's a great way to go for somebody who's maxed out their 401k and they can't do an IRA or they can't do a Roth. That would be an additional way to save some money, even though it'd be related to medical, it would still be another great way to put some money aside.
Exactly right. So have that in the back of your mind as we learn more and more about how the Obamacare rules are going to affect you and as these become more clarified in the future. So lastly, I think we'll briefly talk about a couple House bills that are going through the Oregon legislature that are just interesting of note, half tax related. The first is House Bill 2503 would reduce tax credits at the same rate as reduction allotments, across the board cuts ordered by the governor. So if the governor is going to make an agency take a 10% cut to their budget, the amount for credits and subtractions would also go down by 10% as well. The idea being that if agencies and state employees have to take cuts, then all other citizens will also feel the same cuts.
Can that pass?
It's in the House. It's a House bill right now. So, and then interesting, House Bill 2462 says this bill would exempt the Department of Revenue from allotment reductions, what we just talked about, because if they have found that if they cut funding to the Department of Revenue, it exacerbates the problem of the shortfall. So apparently, the state coffers are exempt from this. So just little things to be aware of going on in our down the road in Salem.
Wow. Well, you know, it always amazes me on when you hear some of these big government jobs. And one of the things, you know, I got to give credit to the government unions and the powerful organization they became, because when you think about the president of the United States gets a $400,000 salary, well, I think it was Battleground paid their superintendent of schools to leave, gave him a $400,000 kicker to leave. So, you know, I mean, this whole thing, salaries are totally out of whack in the government. And, you know, when you think about Geithner, when the government gave him a bonus to pay off his taxes, a $500,000 bonus, I'd like to know what company out there, you know, what private company, now maybe some big major corporations, pay a guy a bonus to come to work for him. I haven't seen that.
Well, I don't know. Of course, yeah, of course, you know, and then you think about the wealth manager guys that, you know, ran their companies into the ground and got bonuses. I mean,
well, the bankers.
Yeah, the bankers.
The
you know,
banks,
I mean,
that went bankrupt and their CEO got $20 million.
Yeah, I mean,
how crazy is that?
I mean, even if they did a great job, you have to wonder about the utility of all that.
Well, you know, one of the misunderstood things about Bernie Madoff was a guy that you know, took money and stole money. But one of the things that I hear a lot of bad articles about hedge fund managers and guys that are managing large amounts of money and stuff, and generally those guys are paid on commission. If the fund does well, they make money. If the fund loses money, they get fired. I mean, it's kind of Fisher cut bait. And so, you know, it'd be kind of nice if we could kind of boil every business down. In a way, we all work on that basis too. I mean, you know, you have clients and you work in a fee agreement with them. And Kevin does the same and I do the same. We all work that way. So we all have an incentive to get the jobs done for our clients, to keep our clients happy so they come back and do more business with us. To me, it'd be great if government could kind of work that way, too, where they get paid for what they do. And if they don't do it, then they don't get paid. That would be a very interesting thing. And it'd be great if they could take the Congress and the president and tie their salaries to the national debt. If the debt doesn't go down, their salaries don't go up. I think that's only fair.
Sounds like good stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with the Knowledge Trust. You're listening to Investing Simplified on a Saturday morning in Portland, a little overcast, a little bit of drizzle coming down, but it's going to be a much better day in the afternoon. Say goodnight to me.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million...
Well, Kevin, you got an interesting article there about somebody that probably most people do or at least have heard of.
That's right, and I think it should spur some interesting discussion. James Gandolfini, several weeks ago, passed away, as most of us heard, an untimely death. And he had just executed an estate plan in December the year before. And since he did not have a trust, which would have made his estate plan mostly private, we got a chance to look into his estate plan and his tax plan of it also. And so I know, Carl, you read his will, and I read his will, which is a very interesting read.
It was an interesting read. It was a lot different than you might have expected. Of course, not knowing, you know, Mr. Soprano and not knowing his family. It was different than what you might have expected, in the sense that I think the big thing that struck me was that he was married, but he provided 20% to his spouse, and the rest went to other beneficiaries in various proportions. But the interesting thing about that was that he had a very large estate, and so by only transferring 20% to his spouse, that means only a very small portion qualified for the marital deduction, meaning that the rest of it was vulnerable to tax.
That's exactly right. So by the numbers, he had a $70 million estate, and I believe they ended up with a $30 million tax bill.
Right.
Well, and they just did an estate plan the year before?
Well, they executed the will, and it appears that taxes were not a significant consideration in all of this.
No, the will was basically a straightforward will. It says, I give this much to my wife, I give this much to this A, B, C, D.
Did he get it off of Amazon or someplace?
No. It was obviously written by a lawyer, and it was long. It was fairly substantial. It just ignored the tax.
How would you have a guy with that kind of an asset and totally ignore estate planning?
I don't know.
Well, the tax tail must not have been a significant consideration. Now, maybe there's, you know, maybe his wife was so well taken care of by other means,
right,
that he really wanted, he gave 20% to the wife, mm-hmm, 30% to two sisters, and another 20% to his daughter. And so maybe the 30% to the two sisters was more important to him than any tax savings.
Yeah, maybe it was drafted by the consigliere,
the hotel.
No. Yeah, could be.
I don't know, but
maybe Robert Duvall came down there and wrote it up or something.
Whale,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So. But you would have thought, though. I mean, at least they would have did a living trust to avoid the publicity on it.
It's hard to say, but it was interesting. I think because the other thing that's very interesting is that, and I don't know what I think the probate's in the state of New York, and I don't know what the New York laws are, but every state has some kind of a law which allows the spouse who has a disappointing distribution in the will to elect against the will and claim a certain percentage of the estate. And under Oregon law, depending on the age of the marriage and things like that, a person, a disinherited spouse, could conceivably claim up to 25% of the net estate, including not only the probate estate, but the assets, that which we would usually call the gross estate of the...
No, was he in the state of New York?
Is
that a community property, or do you know?
I don't think New York's a community property state.
Okay. Yeah. Well, wouldn't his spouse have had to sign off on that?
Well, not necessarily. Not if he wasn't a community property state. And if it were otherwise, and if she chooses, she would have to make the decision as to try to go against the will if that's what she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But maybe like Kevin said, maybe she was so well provided for in other ways that, mm-hmm. maybe over the last 10 years they've transferred assets to the spouse via lifetime gifts, and she has, everything she needs.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing this ought to show everybody, and I couldn't believe it, of course, with Michael Jackson and some of the other people that have died recently and not had wills done, set up correctly and stuff, you would think that people that have that amount of money would go and get the best possible legal and tax advice they could get.
Well, maybe this, for reasons we don't know, it was a good thing. I mean, I have a hard time, like you. I can't imagine that he hired a lawyer that didn't know what they were doing. I mean, that just didn't.
Well, even if he wanted the money to go to his sisters or to his daughter, the use of a trust in probate, getting through probate would have been, well, hey, that's our little cue. We're going to be heading out of here. Carl, how does somebody get a hold of you?
We are at 503-255-8795. We're on 122nd Avenue and warrenallen.com.
And Kevin?
BakerColson.com, 503-666-5569. And we're located on Division Out 242nd.
Okay, and Price Financial Group Wealth Management, www.pfgwm.com at 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. And we're conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue in the Mall 205 area, Suite 103. Thank you very much. And next week on Investing Simplified, we'll have an encore presentation of the interview the three of us did with Harry Dent. So don't miss that. If you didn't get to hear it, you want to hear that show, and you can also catch it on my website. Thank you very much, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.